closing things. Welcome to Once Upon a Time, Fables, Fairy Tales, Myths, and Other Tall Tales in Grammar Novels. I'd like to actually have you guys introduce yourselves because you can do yourself much better justice than I can. So if you want to start on the end there, as many of you might know, Jenny Hall.
Hi, I'm Jenny Hall. I'm the sister of the brothers of Jakeem, and we do, my brother's just sleeping in tonight. Yes, he's sleeping well. We do the Baby Mouse series, the Switch series, my first comics, and the Sunny series.
Is mine on? Okay, yep. I'm Corey McDonald. I am a teacher librarian at a high school here at Ramona High School in San Diego.
I'm Erin Hill. I also work at Ramona High School, and I have done everything from teaching in Japan to training donkeys, and high school students are by far the most entertaining.
My name is Alexis Fajardo, and I'm a cartoonist. I do the graphic novel series Kibeo Wolf, and my other hat in the world is I am editor at the Charles M. Schulz Studio, so I can talk about Snoopy too if you want.
And I wanted to point out that Alexis is now an Eisner winner.
They're heavy, and it was quite a thrill. And that's a book that the studio put together, and I just got to hold the trophy. So
it was a collection of peanuts, right?
Yeah. It's called Celebrating Snoopy. It's basically 50 years of Snoopy. We culled the best from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and it's peppered throughout with commentary about Snoopy's impact on all of us. So.
Wow, you were all very brief. This is wonderful. I need to try this now. I'm Talia Hurwicz. I have previously been a middle school writing teacher. I'm coming out a book with Meryl Jaffe on, it's called Worth a Thousand Words. It's about using graphic novels in the ELA classroom, middle school and elementary school. And I'm currently a researcher at New York University looking at comic books and graphic novels in science and ELA education classrooms.
Thank you. So I wanted to start maybe with the creators. I know we have two different kind of tracks in this panel. We have our two creators, and then we have teachers who are using the graphic novels. But I wanted to start with our creators. Jenny and Les. Jenny, do you want to talk a little bit maybe about how you've used these kind of stories in Baby Mouse? It's more of an adaptation for you rather than taking a traditional tale. How do you guys weave those into your stories?
So we kind of like do a Baby Mouse fractured fairy tale version of well-known nursery stories and fables, and we always kind of put Baby Mouse at the head of whatever we're talking about. So usually within the comic, she has a problem and she starts to dream of something, and then she kind of becomes that character. And we've also even used it where we have kids actually like fill in the comics. We do like a Red Riding Hood where Baby Mouse is going through she goes through her locker and she ends up in the dark woods, and there's lockers instead of trees, and it's like her version of school. So we just kind of take a little twist on all the fairy tales.
Thanks. And Lex, do you want to talk a bit about your work, which is very, very good.
It's nice to be in a venue like this because I don't necessarily have to struggle about, have you ever heard of Beowulf? That's sort of the seed for my work, and I do a twist in my universe. Beowulf and Grendel are 12-year-old twin brothers. The first book in the series explains all that, but it's basically a stepping stone for them to travel across Europe and Asia, meet all the other epic heroes, get into other adventures, kind of slowly discover their true destiny, which is, if you've read Beowulf, you know what that is. And in a hopefully not too didactic kind of way, kind of point people back to the original source material. The second book is based on the Song of Roland, which is a French epic, and then book three comes out in just a couple weeks, and that's based on the Spanish epic, El Cid.
Excellent, thank you. And that sort of leads me into what the project that Erin and Corey worked on, Beowulf. Do you guys want to explain a bit about your project?
We did it with the Odyssey, but yeah.
Oh, sorry, it was the Odyssey. Okay, well.
European.
Yeah.
Tales. I'm sorry. Yeah, it was, did you use Gerritheim's
adaptation of the Odyssey?
Can you just tell us a bit about, the project that came about and what you guys do?
So we had been using the the actual text, the translated text of the Odyssey for quite a while, and we'd also used the 1996 TV adaptation, chunks of that, to try and supplement it. And I love TV adaptations, don't get me wrong, but it was wonderful to have this kind of medium come in where we had words on a page that the kids were able to use and read through the entire story, not just chunks, not just pieces of it. But when we started using it, I saw the kids get really more excited about what they were reading. There was a lot more enthusiasm in the classroom, and I have kids that are not readers because either they just don't like books, which I hear all the time, or they are in special ed, or they really struggle with reading itself. And those kids were the ones that had the hardest time putting the book down, which was always really exciting to see. So we use all three of those now. We use the original, we use Gareth Hines and the TV version, and integrate all of those things together into a unit where they're able to examine the Odyssey and how it progresses.
And you use this across ninth grade, right?
All every ninth grade language arts class. It's interesting, though, because, like she pointed out, you know, certain kids really couldn't put the book down. And so then people said, oh, what about your honors kids? The honors kids actually struggled probably more so than the others in the classroom because not everything is just clearly written in the text. It's not just here you go and you can just read. They have to make inferences from the visuals and the pictures and the art within it. And so it actually was a good, like, bridging the gap equalizer between all of the different levels of students in the class. So all ninth grade classes, whether it was an honors ninth grade class or a core ninth grade class, all utilized it.
That's great. And I want to get into that in a minute about why comics and why do we use comics, how are they good for this kind of thing. But I wanted to go to Talia, so did you want to talk about either your project with Merrill or the project you were telling me about with the Jewish Tales? That was great.
So one of the things that I'm doing is, this is in the early stages, I'm taking graphic novel adaptations of the Bible, particularly when gender comes into play, because gender comes into play several times, and put them in front of high school students who know the stories already. And the idea is that when you're given the Bible, it's the Bible. If you are critical about the Bible, you are putting yourself in a certain camp. If you're critical of a comic book, you're just talking about a comic book. And so one of the ideas is using graphic novels, and particularly graphic novel adaptations of stories that are deep within our world, and have a lot of political, religious, spiritual underpinnings in them, and creating a little bit of distance to allow for student creativity in their readings. And this is in the early stages, so I can let you know perhaps next year how it goes. Up until then, there's just theory.
Sounds like a great project. Thanks. That sort of, I wanted to, I have a few slides here. When we talk about, I know we used the phrases fairy tales and myths in the title, but there are a number of different types of tales, fables, fairy tales, myths, but also folk tales, tall tales, legends, all of those things. And some of the things that they have in common are some of the things that make them important that to use with our students. I'm looking at this very small one here. The idea is that they are rooted in a particular place and a particular culture in many cases. And so by giving them to our students and working through them with students, they can develop, and Katie talked about this in the last panel, empathy with people who are not like them, with other cultures, through these kinds of tales. And I wanted to talk about how does the medium of comics, now I'm going to interject here, you guys know comics is a medium, not a genre. Right? That is a rally and cry that a lot of us use all the time. In fact, Amy Chu has pencils that say comics is a medium, not a genre. So it is a storytelling format, just like movies, just like novels. Comics is what we're calling graphic novels, which is just a big fat comic. It's a medium. What does the medium of comics bring to these kinds of stories that might provide a different experience for students and for readers than just a prose?
Well, I know for myself, it brings accessibility. So in the case of my adaptation of Beowulf, I think Beowulf gets a bad rap because it's the sort of thing that, you know, even Woody Allen jokes about, you know, never take a class where they make you read Beowulf. So it sort of has this musty, dusty kind of, only people that have elbow patches can really talk about Beowulf. So comics, though, sort of shucks that all away, and you can just get to what it really is, which is just an entertaining story about a guy who goes around killing monsters, which I think, you know, a younger reader can relate, not so much relate to, but be entertained by and interested in. So in that respect, comics are terrific, and the colors are great, and it's just an inviting medium. I think you see a comic, and you want to pick it up and investigate it.
Yeah, I agree with that too, that the kids see it as an accessible medium, and also it almost feels a little bit naughty, like you're getting away with something when you're reading a graphic novel or a comic in class, because that's something that you do on your fun time. That's something that you do at home where your mom's yelling at you and saying, go take out the trash, and instead you have this comic that you want to read. So when a teacher gives you permission to read that, that's makes it a little bit more exciting in the classroom too. And it opens up all these doors for low readers. And then I've got those kids now hooked, and they're asking me about the original stuff, and so then it's easier for them to get into a translated poem from ancient Greek than it would have been for them to be presented with that in the beginning. I mean, if I handed them the actual original ancient Greek written down, which isn't the original because it was spoken, then it would also do them a disservice. So I think that having that gateway to get in is really important, and comics really provide that.
And I think it's also that they're actually super important. I mean, we live in a visual world. And most people in this room have probably had to make a PowerPoint at some point in their lives, right? Even to present, like, you all deserve raises from your principal. No, that's what we should be doing. But in most jobs in life, they're going to have to know how to show visually, to sell something, to advocate for something, to teach something. And comics are like the most basic way of starting to learn how to do that. And it breaks out so easily. You know, here is the dialogue, here is the action, here is the text. So it's kind of starting their chops on what they're going to have to use in the real world, I think, pretty good.
And to add one final thing, I guess, one of the things that I love about comics is that you have to include the setting all the time. So if it is the Odyssey, you see ancient Greece all the time. You see the fashions, you see how the household is set up. And it's a window into the culture in a way that in prose you would get a paragraph, you would get an aside. It's something that you have to kind of put other things on hold. And in a comic book, you don't put it on hold. It's just there.
Yeah, right.
And sadly, the artist has to draw it all.
Yes.
Yes.
Of course. I actually was very fortunate to meet Scott McCloud the other night, and if you know who he is, his works, Understanding Comics and Making Comics, and what's the third one? But those are sort of the Bible of how comics work, and whenever a teacher asks, what do I go to try to figure out what comics are and how I teach them to my kids, go to Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. It's really the first thing that you should look at. And I told him that, and he said, oh, thank you very much about the books. You know? And then he walked away. He came back 5 minutes later, and he said, you know, I want to point out something, though. He said, you know, a lot of people start with a book like Mouse or Persepolis, and, you know, a seminal work of literature. And he said, I would challenge people to start with a worthless comic. And the one he recommends is one that I recommend. It's Sean Tan's The Arrival. It's an immigration story, but it's done in a way that it can be relatable to anyone because there is no text. It is a wordless comic. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. It can be used from kindergarten to college. And he pointed out, when you are looking at a book with text, it's really easy for you to rely on words and to rely on the text. And you look at plot and theme and all those things through the words. But with a wordless comic, you have to look at the visuals and you have to analyze. Students have to analyze what's going on in the picture. So that's just a tip. The master's guy in class. Thank you. I wanted to go back to something that you talked about a little bit, which is text pairings. So taking different versions of something and putting them together. You sort of do that in your stories where you're taking Beowulf and mixing it with El Cid.
Oh, yes.
How did I decide to do that?
The general conceit was that they would travel to the other countries that have epics. And of course, the timelines do not sync up because Beowulf is 7th century and El Cid is sort of 10th century, so there's like a 300-year gap. I sort of, in my head, visualize it as they enter each country, they're sort of getting to that country's golden age. And if you're in for it that Beowulf and Grendel are brothers, then hopefully, you know, people won't stutter at that. So, but at the back of every book, I do provide a lot of grounded text. So if someone were to teach it, you know, the kids would not be confused, or hopefully understand that there's in that comic universe, these sort of things can coexist. And thematically, though, a lot of these epics, the same struggles that Beowulf is going through, the same search for identity and the idea of, you know, morality and figuring all those things out as a human being, that translates over across each of these stories. So Beowulf's journey in book three is very similar to El Cid's journey, as both are trying to figure out like the right moral path, and then those stories kind of converge.
I think that's where education is going right now. You know, it used to be the teacher was the master, and you teach, and the kid just takes the information in your class. And now we really are encouraging, especially through Common Core, we're encouraging students to analyze and critically think. And so when you bring in the multiple measures and different mediums to it, you know, they can compare and contrast. And you, in order to really do that effectively, they have to know each version and be able to see, like, what are the differences and what stands out about this versus this. And it brings such a deeper level of understanding to what you're teaching versus just teaching one medium and here it is. But I want you to love it, because let's be honest, I didn't read the classics. I know I'm a librarian, but I did not read the classics. It was not fun for me. I thought my English teacher wanted to just make my life miserable. So seeing different mediums and bring that in and really comparing, and I like to argue. So being in an argumentative and like, well, no, this one and this, it just adds such a level of understanding that one medium can't do.
So you guys, did you use how many versions of the Odyssey?
For the Odyssey, yeah, we used the original, or the translation of the original epic poem. We used chunks of that, and then we used the entire graphic novel, and we also interspersed that with pieces of the TV adaptation. And so depending on where we're at, they're getting all three of those versions. And then they do comparisons and contrasts where they're looking at which one was more effective, which one did you like better, and why. And so they have to explore both like their emotional reaction to it and also like this storyteller, the way that they decided to put this together and the order that they put it together, and it was slightly different. Why did they make that decision? And so in addition to looking at it as a text, they're also looking at it as a choice that the creator made. And that then lets them, because our end product is they make their own comic, or they can also write out a narrative. And with that, they have to make those creative decisions. And so they've already been thinking about why do people make those decisions, and then they have to take that and go into it themselves, which is really fun for us to see. And then we get to read it and ask them about it. Why did you do that?
That's great.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that when you're analyzing graphic novels with your students, you want to look a lot at creator intent and creator decisions, not only in the words, but you know, in the images. Why are the panels laid out this way? Why is that this color? Why do you want to look at all of those things? Anybody on anything else about text pairings? Anything you can recommend? I know there are other versions available. Neil Gaiman did a version, quite, I would say, high or up. It's rather dark.
Yeah, there's the CGI version. Gaiman took some interesting turns, though, in... He sort of made a familial dynamic, which I thought was really interesting, because we were sort of on the same page, and that felt good. And then I was going to say Gareth Hines, he has a tremendous version of Beowulf that I think is probably in most classrooms and ought to be. And it's a visceral, primal, really intense version that is, I've gleaned a lot from reading that. And there's a terrific version that just came out from Image. I think David Rubin is the artist on that, which has another take, and actually the cover is terrific because it's Beowulf's helmet superimposed over Grendel's maw, and that duality, that whole dynamic, just in a visual, is so compelling and brilliant.
Yeah, you can imagine the conversation that would come out of that in the classroom just from one image.
Right.
I think another obvious one is Romeo and Juliet. It's like,
so many.
I know, my son is. Wasn't ninth grade last year, and they did Romeo and Juliet, and they did all. They just did two thirds. I wish you had been his teachers. they read the text and watched the movie. I'm like, there's a comic book out there.
There's a lot of versions of
that.
One of my favorite versions is, I feel like it's called the Strathmore Zoo. It's a grown novel where the animals in the zoo act out Romeo and Juliet, and in another one they do Macbeth, and it's hilarious. That's a fun one to bring. Have you ever seen it?
I haven't seen that one. I'll have to look into it.
And you can extend that too, because in our ninth grade classes, they also have the kids actually do the acting, and they all dress up, and they do, you know, so you play in that piece of it as well.
And choose a theme too, so they don't have to do it in like traditional Romeo and Juliet. They can do it at Star Wars.
Yes.
There you go. Yeah, and John was talking in the last panel about Prince of Cats, which is an African-American adaptation of it as well. There's so many adaptations out there. One thing I really love about something like Shakespeare is Shakespeare was not really meant to be read as a play. It was meant to be seen. And how do you bring that, yes, in a movie, yes, in a play, but in a graphic novel? So there are many good adaptations out there. I'm going to struggle with the name of it, but there is a company that does sort of manga adaptations at three different reading levels.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I remember the name of that. I'll have to look it up.
But they do. You can get Romeo and Juliet in three different reading levels. The images are the same. It's just the text. So you have original text in one. Do you know it?
No, I don't.
I will find it.
Me too.
And I will put it out there. I think it's, I want to say it's manga classics. But it has a bunch of classic works with graphic novels, and they just change the text to different reading levels, so I'll pull that up. Maybe you guys can chat a little bit. One of the other things that came up in the last panel, and somebody mentioned it here, was the idea that these sorts of tales have traditionally been orally passed down, and they help people figure things out. Either they're an explanation for something we don't understand, or they're about a human condition in some way. I didn't know if Jenny, you want to speak to a little bit about how you take an idea like that and take it to the level of kids that you're talking to, because you do that really well.
Yeah, I mean, I think what is universal about a lot of fairy tales and fables is it's all about a hero's journey, and Baby Mouse is the hero's journey through elementary school, and the folks you're fighting in are at the lunch table or in the classroom. I think what we try to do is really put the fairy tale from the POV of an 8-year-old kid, you know, so they don't know that a lot of the original Grimm's fairy tales were dark and bloody and scary, and then they've seen the Disney version, so we kind of do it, so they imagine what's their like kid version. And so in Baby's idea of Cinderella, she's her best friend is a ferret, he becomes her ferret godmother. And she's going to the ball, but there's no pumpkin, there's a banana. So she's the mouse in the fairy tale, and her job is to pull the banana to the ball. So it's all like little twists on that, like kind of a lighter, funnier version of it. And some of it is just taking kind of more like literature, Tale of Two Cities. You know, she's stuck in prison.
Which one?
France. Yeah, he's in jail. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the one.
Right. Yep.
Okay, just checking. I'm gonna fail this on Monday. you know, she's stuck in prison. That prison is like, sorry, math class, and she's registered writing things on the wall.
Does she conquer them in the end, though?
So in Baby Mouse Dragon Slayer, this is probably the most epic one. She does. She conquers her fear of math and fractions. And so the dragon is made up of fractions, and she conquers her fear. So it's okay.
I think one of the beautiful things about, like, particularly distinguishing between fairy tales and myths is that so much of fairy tales is about being a kid. And, like, being a kid is not easy, and it accepts that. And so, like, there's this one folktale that I love to bring to my kids. It's this Norwegian folktale called Little Freddy and His Fiddle. And it's no one's ever heard of it, or very few people have heard of it. Effectively, it starts like a normal folk tale. There's a kid. He lives a rough life. He has a job with the sheriff. He, after several years, gets only 3 coins for, you know, due pay, to which he gives away to what turns out to be a magical creature that gives him 3 items. I then have the kids pause there and say, okay, tell me how you think this is gonna end. They all give their thoughts, their ideas, and then we continue to read about how Freddy takes those gifts and just rampages across town, potentially killing the man that abused him. And you pause and you sit with them and go, okay, why does it end this way? Are you that surprised by it? And they pause and they say, you know, he had a rough life. He had parents who did not tell him this is how you behave. This was his model. And so you start to think about, like, what it means to be a kid. What are the things that they should be thankful for? And, you know, I had this 10-year-old girl afterwards. We had them then start to write their own fractured fairy tales. And she had this beautiful idea of recreating Cinderella, but where Cinderella was on the spectrum. And her mother was an overly protective, or her stepmother was an overly protective person who just kept her at home because she was so nervous, so concerned. Unfortunately, this was something that she never finished. This was something that everyone that the kids ended up voting on, because as a graphic novel, they were doing it in teams, and the rest of the group just wasn't on the same page as she was. She's 20 years old now, this girl, which is a little terrifying for me. I really hope somewhere out there there's a hard copy of this story, because it just sounded so beautiful.
These kinds of stories, kids really connect on a personal level. And the adaptations that they can do themselves once they've read the original version, maybe a modern version, maybe a Kate Baby Mouse version or a Kate Bale version, challenge them to, what does this story mean to you? And then either write or have them create their own comics.
I also think, like, for kids.
Right. For kids, and we do this, I do this myself now. When asking like a kid, okay, start writing, write a paper, they just freeze up, right? I freeze up, I get writer's block all the time. Just go sit down and write, because most people are really terrified, because we're kind of brought up in this crazy society. I don't know, it just seems to me lately that I'm hearing this, like, your first thing has to be amazing, you can be a genius. The first line you write has to, nobody revises, it's beautiful. And the truth is that I revise all the time, but teaching kids to do that is hard. And so I think where comics and can help to sort of break the ice is just have the kids, even before they start, you know, analyzing Romeo and Juliet in the text, just have them start doodling out ideas. Just like free, just give them scraps of paper and just doodle. And then they'll, you know, doodle, what are some ideas? You don't have to be a good artist. I do that now for all my books. I'll just make a little, I like to break out a story, I'll do a story arc, and I'll just take a piece of paper, draw a rainbow, and I'll say, okay, I think I know this is the beginning, this is the end, and I'll just like stick figures, I don't draw on math drawings. I'll just stick figure ideas, I'll leave that next to my desk, I'll add things, I'll cross it out, and then he'll feel so freaked out about writing that first sentence, because I know it just changes.
And the other thing is, give them sticky notes. Just write a different idea on each sticky note or a different little doodle, and then you can move them around all you want. You know, throw these out, put these new ones in, and that works really well.
And then you kind of get up and move around, and
And then, you know, uses a different part of your brain when you're drawing rather than writing words. So, one of the things that comes up a lot when people say, let's have the kids make comics, is the kids will say, I can't draw. One of the most popular web comics in the world, XKCD, is stick figures. Yeah. It's okay. It doesn't have to be realistic. If you don't want to draw people, make it an orange and an apple. You know, something that you can draw. That's okay. Do it anyway. Do you guys come up against that when you're...
Yeah, I mean, I think what's great is, so I love collaborating. And I think this is the perfect opportunity for like collaboration in classrooms. One kid will probably feel a little bit more confident in the art, and one might be more confident in drawing. That's a really useful skill to learn in life. Not too many of us just work by ourselves. We have to learn how to work with other people. And it doesn't seem to me like the teenagers are as quite as many are getting jobs where they're learning those skills, like just how to collaborate with other human beings. Like, I feel like it's a very important.
You know, one idea that just came to mind is, like, we're all carrying around these devices that we're all framing shots. We're all actually creating panels. So if you have a student who's hesitant to draw, you could have you could actually create the scene with other students, have another student sort of film it. You take a photo of it, and then you can sort of build a narrative that way. And then they understand blocking, they understand pacing, they understand, you know, how much text you can actually fit in perhaps that window, but there are lots of opportunities that way too.
And there's an app, is it Comic Life?
Yeah, Comic Life.
And there's another one.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that I like using, there's Comic Life for the photos, and there's Pixton for the more like illustrated. Pixton.
Yeah. And there's another one called Make Beliefs Comics, which sounds like my favorite. And it has a lot of sort of pre-drawn random characters that they can move around and add text.
I do something in class that's sort of a reverse of that, where we, and teachers have probably heard of this strategy, it's called a listen and sketch, where the kids listen to a certain piece, so as a teacher I can read it or I can play part of the audiobook, and they listen for something they know they're going to have a chance for 1 minute of it to sketch. And so they, during the listening point, they don't have the pencil in their hand, they have to leave it on the ground, they have to pick up an image or something. It could be part of a metaphor, it could be an actually drawing the scene out that they're seeing or the setting, right? And then they sketch that really quick, and it's only a minute that they have to draw, or you can cut it down to 30 seconds. So there's no pressure to be a good artist, because they just need to get something down on the page. Then they have to turn and explain it to a person next to them. Why did you choose that image? What's important about it? How did that help you make sense of it? So it's kind of reverse comic drawing, where they're taking it and making sense of it through a comic that they end up with at the end.
That's great.
Before, there's so much integration of visual and words and everything, and so just taking the kids and saying you have to analyze this piece of dry text, whether that be ancient literature or whether that be an article that was written yesterday, you know, it doesn't matter. If all they're seeing is text and stuff that they have to analyze, they're not going to take that skill of analyzing and apply that to the TV shows that they're watching or the commercials or whatever piece of news that they're reading. They need to be able to do that, and so I think that it's really important for us to bring all these different mediums in, because if we don't, they're not going to have those critical skills to put back into the world when they graduate.
That's great.
I mean, one of the other things that like really gets my goat, and because I work with middle schoolers, it's a little different than with high school, because in middle school we're still talking about how to critique writing, let alone art. But kids seem to think that they either can or cannot draw, that they're artists or they're not. And like, we're really good at teaching them that you become a writer. You gain skills, you learn it, and at first you're not going to be that good, but you're going to get better. We don't do that when it comes to art. We allow kids to say, you know what, I just can't draw, and that's it. And so what I like to do is I like to have them tell me how to draw a panel from Little Red Riding Hood. Because I'm not a good artist. My big bad wolf looks more like a squirrel. And as they do it, it's all about listening to how they give me input. And it's about modeling how kids talk to each other about how to improve their ability to draw. And it can be stick figures with expressive faces or whatnot. But I think that in a visual world, we need to be a lot more sensitive to the idea that drawing is something that you develop as a skill, as opposed to you have or have not.
Yeah, I think that's something that we don't teach in school, unfortunately, in a lot of cases. And it's, is it Malcolm Gladwell talks about 10,000 hours? Sorry. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. We don't have the, that's the first thing that gets cut. We don't have that music in our career. Yeah. So, yeah, that's definitely something that we've all liked to see come back. Yeah. It's a different kind of literacy that students go on. I wanted to, before we get to questions, because I know you guys probably have questions, run through some titles. And if, as I go through these, if you guys think of anything you want to say about them, starting with the younger readers, this is a series of anthologies from first to second. This is really aimed at younger readers, but the older kids love them because they're hilarious. Every artist does their version of it, and they're all very silly, and they're all very fun. So there's fable comics, fairy tale comics, and nursery rhyme comics. And, you know, people with younger students know people like Raina Telgemeier, and they're there's a lot of that. Did you do some of these?
No.
But then should.
Yeah.
Next one they do. Okay. You have to be in it. This is a brand new book that I read the other day that is fantastic. Karine Hernandez, who did Love and Rockets, did The Dragon Slayer, which is, I think there were four folk tales in here from Latin America. Fantastic book, if you can pick that one up. Classics Illustrated, you know, those are Fairy by who does the adaptation. Those, there are three titles there that I like. How many people here have ever heard of Good. Teachers and librarians tend to know about Capstone, but the comics world just really doesn't know who they are. Yeah. Their market is schools and libraries, and they have hundreds of graphic novels, especially at the lower reading level. So they have some fairy tale, mixed up fairy tales. There's a modern one, and then there's a more classical one. This is a great book, Rapunzel's Revenge, and then the follow-up was Calamity Jack by the, all three Hales,
yeah.
Jan and Nadine. And then the artist is Nathan. Fantastic reimagining of a great deal of incredible art. That's a great one. Usually they do stuff for younger readers, but they have a slightly older series on mythology. And there's some other adaptations there. The Shark King, that's a great one. From a culture field you hear a lot about, which is nice. Trickster is a Native American Tales anthology, and Matt and Mickey edited that. Black Hole of Norway's View, I have not read it. I don't even know if it's out yet, but it looks amazing. It's an Irish tale done by two sisters. Gareth Hines, obviously. Those are his main three books. But if you have slightly younger readers, George O'Connor's Olympian series, fantastic. How many is he up to?
I love this.
He's like
on so good. Yeah.
8 or 9, I think.
8 or 9.
Yeah.
And then Eric Shanover, those are definitely an older read. I always would say you'd have to go college on that because those gods and goddesses were rather promiscuous. And
right.
Yes.
yeah, older readers for Eric's Age of Bronze. You saw him too, I just pulled this up because I was watching The Eisners and he just won Best Lawyer again. Tales from Japan, which is fantastic. He's a rabbit
samurai. Yep.
Fantastic book. Monsters just won, I didn't count, 5 or 6. Eisner's last night. It's fantasy, but it really feels like an actual old tale from a culture we've never seen before. And the art is eye-poppingly beautiful, and almost all the characters are women. The women are the ruling class in all cases in this book, so that's a great one. That's a teen novel book. Marvel 1602 is an adaptation that Neil Gaiman did, where he put all the characters from Marvel in.
The New World.
The New World, yeah. It's really strange and interesting and fun. I like that one a lot. Probably older readers on that. And then somebody recommended to me Thor on Heaven and Earth, where Thor meets a Catholic priest. Hmm. And they have sort of a, who's right, discussion. Fables, again, probably older readers. That's a long-running series that they take fables, fairy tales, and all these things, and weave them into a rather adult story where they live in New York. And then I'm a huge Hellboy fan. The nice thing about Hellboy is that honestly, violence is going to be your only issue there, and not all the stories are very violent, especially when he does things like adapt an old tale like The Corpse or The Iron Shoes. They're short stories, so you can use them. They just won an Eisner last night for the short story about Krampus. So that's a good one to use right at Christmas time. Beautiful art. And then I have a couple lists here if you want to take pictures of those. It includes titles around here. I'll leave that up for a minute. I have one for older readers that I'll put up in a second, too. But I wanted to leave time for questions. I didn't know if anybody in here, does anyone have questions? Yes, sir.
This is for Alexa. What year did you give
So wait, I'm sorry.
So it wasn't the Eisner that he won was not for Kid Bill. It's for another book that he worked on with the Peanut strips. Because he has two lives.
Yes.
He's an author, but he also works for Schultz. And
I hope to very much one day win an Eisner for Kid Bill.
It would be a fantastic, book for your other people.
For sure. Well, there are, I'm going to have to look up. There is a comic company in India that I work with that has beautiful, beautiful comics doing the entire Hindu pantheon. So I'm
there's an adaptation of the Mahabharata somewhere.
Yeah, there are a few, and you can get them here.
And there's the great Osamu Tezuka. I'm blanking. It's a 9-volume epic on the life of Buddha. It's astounding, and it's definitely worth finding. And he also did one about the phoenix, which is sort of tied to those myths as well. Highly recommend it.
The next one. This is the older readers list. Did anybody else have?
Home unless I have a really slow reader, and so we do it in a variety of ways just because I get bored if I'm seeing the same thing over and over again. So my favorite is probably the small group readings, and what we have them do is they don't just read the text that's on the page, they narrate their panels. And so depending on the day, I'll have them do, you have a panel, your next person has a panel, your next person, or you read a whole page, or you read 3 pages, or whatever. But they're reading through it and they're saying, okay, Odysseus is walking down on the beach, he's wearing blue. And then they know, because we've talked about symbolism and that there's different colors of importance, that they're looking for those details, and so they're expressing them verbally too. And I also allow kids to ask questions during that point as well. So if somebody's like, no, that's not blue, that's purple, then they can have that challenge there too. But they're narrating at the same time as they're reading the text. And if I walk around and I catch a kid that's just reading out of bubbles, then everybody else gets their glare on, and they all make them read the actual things that are doing the work. As far as full class readings, I've not tried to do a one kid reads a large page to the entire class, because for my students that'd be a little bit intimidating.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we'll also take a certain page that's really, really dense with symbolism or with something important for the plot of the story, and we have them do what we call a panel analysis, where they start out in the first section is they're really just observing. They're just looking. They're writing down what colors do you see. They're writing down what characters do you see. They're writing down what important words are jumping out at you. And then the next level down is analysis. So they're taking that and they're taking it apart and saying, okay, well, I know the blue is linked to Athena every time she shows up. She's framed in blue. Everything that she touches is framed in blue. So maybe this has something to do with Athena, or this is a symbol of evil or whatever. So they're attaching meaning to those things that they observed. And then the last thing is they take that and they attach that to outside world stuff. So what does this remind you of in the real world? And so there's a variety of different ways to do that. We have a worksheet that we use. We also have something that we call a visual writing prompt, where they look at it and then they write a paragraph based on it. And so you can take it, you can do a whole bunch of different things for it. And because it's a graphic novel, it's a fast read if you don't slow them down. And so part of the you can't take it home is if you take it home, you're going to be done with it the next day when you bring it back in. So that it's sort of enforced. And still, I have kids that are done with it 3 weeks early. And so I tell them, okay, well, but during the group reading time, you still have to read it with your group, and you have to review the pages that we're reading for that day.
I do a lot with elementary school kids, a variation of what you're doing. So we do a lot of live readers theater with elementary school kids, and put it on an album, and I run it like an old radio play. So somebody's playing Baby Mouse, somebody's playing Wilson, somebody is the narrator, but it's a whole class participation because I have which they love, and they have a very noisy classroom, so, you know, they'll act up the whole thing, and, you know, and we cast against this guy sometimes, like, you know, what would we make now? It's totally fine, you know?
I'm stealing that. And with graphic novels also, like, because it's so quickly gone through, you can do some really good close reading, because they take it home, they read through it, and then you get to do deep dives and selections, and that's when you open up to a section that you think is critical, and then you have them start to narrate it, do something that would, like what Jenny did, and play the director. You get to start saying, okay, is this actually how this would be said? What is happening in between those panels? And you can really start going into those foundational elements that constitute close reading.
We talk a lot about gutters, too.
And as a creator, this is really thrilling to hear, because we're spending long hours at the drawing board, and we're thinking of these things, but we don't know if they're being disseminated. So it's exciting to know that you guys are deep dives. I love it.
I wanted to give you, before we run out of time here, some resources, because I know some of you had asked. I did look up the Shakespeare at three different levels. It comes from a company called Classical Comics. It's at classicalcomics.com. They have a number of different books, not just Shakespeare, but also some of the classics. They come in original text, plain text, and quick text, and they do give you silent measures for those as well. So I found that. The other thing is, the kind of questions you're asking about, how do I teach graphic novels? There are a few resources for that. One is Pop Culture Classroom, which is a group I work with. They run Denver Comic Con. Their website has a lot of resources on it. So just go to Pop Culture Classroom, go to the link that says the classroom or the educator section, and there are a lot of resources in there that you guys can use. Another resource is, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund runs a series of columns by Meryl Jaffe that are called,
There's Raising a Reader?
There's that, I'm thinking of the columns that she does for different, like there's one on Baby Mouse. And she does call a bunch of those for different, can you read it?
But just go to
cdlbf.org
and
just
go to the resource
and
there's tons of
Using graphic novels in education. Pretty fast. And she does it for a lot of different books that people use, like American Born Chinese and some of the other books. And they're very comprehensive and very well written. She's great at what she does. There is a Facebook group called Comic Book Teachers. It's growing day by day. People are posting a lot of really great resources. I just saw a resource go up there that I need to pull down that someone in Canada posted, that's a bunch of posters about visual literacy and different elements that the kids could be looking for in the graphic novels. And she said that they've used those and their recall on those and their application of those has grown leaps and bounds with these posters. So Comic Book Teachers Facebook group just requested to join. You'll have to answer a couple of questions to prove you're not a bot. And then in that group as well. Self-promotion on Teachers Pay Teachers. I have a unit, a couple things called Graphic Novels Are Elementary. It is aimed at elementary grades, but there's a lot of information there that anyone can use. And on my site, I have some of that stuff for free. So TracyEdmonds.com, there's a lot of good information for free on my resources section. Does anybody else have anything they want to put out?
You go to most of the big publisher sites at Random House and Classic Graphics. They have teaching guides for a lot of their titles and other stuff.
And self-promotional. I'm coming out with a book with Meryl Jaffe, who does the blogs that were just mentioned, specifically about how to teach using comics.
I have read a copy of that. You are going to want to get this book. They cover everything from soup to nuts with examples, and it's really a fabulous book. So, and it's called
Worth a Thousand Words.
Worth a Thousand Words.
And it's coming out when?
Yeah. It's coming, hopefully, knock on wood, September. Yeah, very exciting.
And then I just met a professor from UC Riverside. Her name is Rochelle. And I thought she was going to be here, and she's not here. But she has created a textbook for her college class called Experiencing Comics. And if you Google that, you'll probably find it. I'll also put it on
tell me about it. It's fabulous as well. So that's, I think, also coming out in the fall. So there's two great books coming out that will be super helpful for that. I think we're almost at the end. Does anybody have one more question?